So tonight we're carrying on the sermon series on following and the steps that we take to follow Christ. Tonight is costly steps. The theme is sacrifice. And because the theme is sacrifice and because I am by nature a youth leader, I'm going to ask you to get into twos and play a game of Would You Rather. So please find a friend. And answer each other this question. Would you rather sacrifice meat or chocolate? Go. Okay. Hands up. Hands up if you would relinquish meat from your life. Hands up if you would relinquish chocolate. No, so, okay, it's about half and half. Okay. I thought it was like everybody would die for chocolate. This is what we want. Meat is fine, but no. Okay, would you rather sacrifice all social media or all of the photographs on your phone? Go. So, hands up if you're going to get rid of your social media. Hands up. Oh, there's a lot of people are getting rid of that. Somebody's got two hands up. Just do. I know. You're free to. It's fine. Hands up if you are going to get rid of all of the photographs that are on your phone. There's people who are like, well, I have a camera. I don't have a photograph on my phone. I've got a serious one now. Would you rather... This is where it gets a bit more serious. And I'm not even going to ask you to put your hands up. This is more for conversation and thinking. Would you rather have to live in a foreign country not of your own choosing? So kind of go into exile. But you could still maintain all of your relationships with your family and friends. Maybe you could Skype them, or maybe they would come with you. Or you could continue to live in whatever country you wanted to live, but you couldn't have contact with your family. It's a bit serious. Go, see what you think. I'm going to stop you. I'm not even going to ask you to put your hands up because that's a horrible question. I don't think God is going to ask you to do that. But that is a thing that sometimes happens for people when they choose to follow Jesus. Tonight we're going to talk about sacrifice. And we're going to talk... Yes. We're going to talk about what did Jesus say about it. We're going to talk about what is, when we talk about sacrifice as a Christian, what is that? We're going to talk about what's the promise, because there's a promise attached to Jesus' discussions on sacrifice. And we're going to say, what does it mean to me? So we're going to turn to a passage. If you've got a church Bible anywhere near you, you might want to look at it. It's on page 1012. It's Mark 8. Verses 27 to 38. While you're turning to that, I'll just explain where we are in the kind of the story of the gospel so far. Jesus has been preaching. He's been doing loads of healings, miracles. He's travelled around. He's fed the 5,000. If that wasn't enough, he's fed another 4,000. He's calmed a storm. He's so famous that Gentiles are starting to believe in him and have faith in him. So Jesus is now at peak popularity, right? And at this point, Jesus and his disciples are walking along a road to somewhere that you don't need to know where it is, and they have this conversation. So I shall read it. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" And they replied, "Some say John the Baptist, some say Elijah, still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he said. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You're the Messiah." And Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. And he then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he spoke plainly about this, but Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." Then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and he said, "Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? And what could anyone give in exchange for their soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of them when he comes in his Father's glory with his holy angels." This is the gospel of Christ. My wife Fran and I are part of a Bible study that's going through Mark's gospel bit by bit. It came out of an alpha group that we helped to lead in church earlier this year. So some of us have never read right through a book of the Bible before. And a lot of us, me included, probably haven't done for quite a long time in that kind of detail at all. And we have loved Mark. Mark's gospel is brilliant. It's fast moving. It's exciting. It's occasionally genuinely quite funny. And Jesus in Mark is this electric, quick-witted, miraculous, inspiring, challenging, really sometimes quite frustrating character because he has such high expectations of the disciples. But you just want to be where he is and you don't want to blink and miss something exciting that he's going to do because it's all amazing. And when we came to this passage, we read it and we all went a bit quiet for a minute. Because even though some of us knew this bit was coming, for all of us it was a massive change of gear in the story. It's like we were running along enjoying the story and suddenly the story grabbed us by the collar and goes, "Hold up." Because what's happening is Jesus has been saying and doing some amazing things, and he's been pretty quiet about who he is. So at the start of this passage in verse 27... he and his disciples are on the road and he's quizzing them to see who people think he is. And it's mainly, you don't need to know who all those characters are, it's mainly famous people from Israel's past brought back to life. That's what people are reckoning Jesus is. And then in verse 29, there's this amazing moment where, I'm just going to move this forward so I don't trip over the monitor, and I don't know whether the penny's just dropped or whether Peter is just saying what they've all been thinking, but Peter the disciple says, "You're the Messiah. You're the person that God has sent to save Israel, aren't you? You're the person that was promised by the prophets back in the Bible, back in the Old Testament." And that's the first time, I think, that Jesus or any of the disciples actually say that out loud. And it's quite a spine-tingling moment when you're reading it through. And then Jesus goes, "Well, yes, but hold up. Because me being the Messiah doesn't look like you think it looks. What it's going to look like is this. Everyone in our community who has some kind of authority, they're not going to turn to me. They're going to want to get rid of me. And they're going to find a way to have me killed. And me being the Messiah isn't going to keep me safe from that. But what is going to happen is I'm going to rise again, so you don't need to..." But then you can see in verse 32, Peter's already not listening, and he goes, "No, Jesus, that is not what the Messiah does. The Messiah..." He's read his Old Testament. "The Messiah saves Israel. Come on, Don't talk like that. I left a really good fishing business. We had two boats and I had people working for me. I left that to come for you. Don't tell me that the Messiah loses. Don't tell me the Messiah gets killed. That is not what happens. And Jesus goes, no, that's exactly what the devil would say. In fact, that's what the devil did say to me, says Jesus. 3 years ago, when I was in the desert wrestling with all this stuff, you know, the story of Jesus goes into the desert for 40 days and sort of wrestles with his calling, and the devil appears to him. And the devil took me, he says, to the top of a tall mountain, and he showed me all the kingdoms of the world. And he said, all of this could be yours. Just give me what I want and no one gets hurt. That's just me quoting a U2 song because I like it. But what actually happens in the story is the devil takes Jesus to the top of a mountain, shows him all the kingdoms of the world, and he says, all of this has been given to me. I can give it to you if you'll just bow down and worship me. And the implication is, then you won't have to go through all that suffering that you and I both know is involved in your way of bringing the kingdom. And Jesus says, you see, Peter, you're thinking of a human way of winning a victory. But God's way, it's better, but in a world like this, it's going to hurt. And Jesus calls the crowd back over and he says, look, if any of you wants to be my disciple, it means being willing to suffer like I'm going to suffer. And there will come a point for any of us where there is a sacrifice. To which I, as listening, I'm like, why? But I think there's two types of sacrifice here that he's talking about. And you might call them external and internal. I just made that up. I don't know if it's any help. External, this is what I mean, right? Jesus is saying, if you want to be my disciple, if you want to heal the sick like I do, if you want to operate in God's prayer-answering power that makes the demons shudder, yeah? If you want to be radically loving to everyone like I am, regardless of where they're from or what they've done or whether they could ever do anything for you in return, if you want to hunger and thirst for righteousness and seek to be really pure in your own life and to love God that way, if you want to hunger and thirst for righteousness in the sense of justice and peace in the world, if you want to tell the world there is a kingdom of God and it is here and God loves and wants to meet with every individual, which is all the things that being a disciple of Jesus can mean, then that's going to rub some people up the wrong way. And you're not going to be doing it deliberately. I've got a bit of a Theresa May throat, sorry. But that's going to happen and it's going to be outside of your control. If you're praying faithfully and seeing answers, well, that might make people a bit uncomfortable in a way because it means that there is something in the world that is bigger than what they know exists. And it will certainly make the demons uncomfortable. And that spiritual aspect of our prayer is real. I'm not a massive expert on it, but it is real. And we know there are people in this church community who have experience of that. If you're radically loving to just anyone, if you are hungry for purity in your own life, if you're hungry for justice in the world, that's going to shine a light on practices in your workplace or habits in your family or systems in your society that are not loving or pure or just. And the people who benefit from things being the way they are, or the people who can't imagine there's any other way, might want to shut down that light because it's too bright. And if you're telling the world that there's a kingdom, well, then you're telling the world that there's a king. And that he's asking all of us to put him first. And that's a very uncomfortable thing for people to hear. And they might want to not have to listen to that. So and that could get you into trouble. And that's the first sort, which maybe that's the kind of the taking up your cross side of it. And there's the second sort of sacrifice, which is, I think, kind of denying yourself, which is that going Jesus's way means that you can't go all of these other ways. You can only sort of be going one way at once, you know what I mean? And we're used to thinking of that in terms of, sin, and that's a very important way. But all of those other things are not always wrong. I've always got a bunch of different desires and thoughts and things I might prefer to do, and any number of them could be okay. But I was part of a trip recently to see a good friend of this church who works with, she is a missionary. She introduces Muslims to Jesus in a Middle Eastern country. I won't say any names because this is going on the internet. But before she went over there, she was a successful social worker. And as far as I know, she was very good. She loved it. She loved living in London. She was part of All Saints and she loved you. And she misses you. And none of that was wrong. But she had to give that up. She had to deny her... She didn't have to. She chose to give that up. She chose to deny her career, deny the prospect of a public centre pension, deny Peckham and London and being close to family in order to follow where God was calling her. And all of those things were good. But what was right was to step away from all of those good things into this good thing. And it hurt. But I don't think she regrets it now. Because I don't think I did that. But I'm going to claim I did. Thing is, right? That sacrifice is real, and I don't want to belittle it, and it really hurts, but it comes with a promise. There is a deal that Jesus is asking us to make with him, if you'll pardon that expression. And here and throughout the Bible and throughout history and in the lives of people that we know, the deal is always the same. Jesus has always promised the best, the most exciting, the realest, the fullest life. I am come that they might have life and have it in abundance. And alongside that goes sacrifice. Whether that's external, taking up your cross and facing what people might say to you, or internal, denying yourself and making decisions that are away from the stuff that you already love. You remember in John's Gospel, the night before he died, Jesus said, "In this world you will have many troubles, but take heart, for I have overcome the world." And a few chapters after tonight's passage in Mark 10, Jesus is going to say to some disciples, "Truly I say to you, no one who has left home or brothers or sisters," this is the promise, "no one who has left home or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or fields," and by fields he's talking about belongings, talking about businesses, income streams, financial security, knowing where you're going to, what you're going to sell when you're old, all of that stuff, "for me and for the gospel, no one who's done that stuff will fail to receive 100 times as much in this present age. Homes, brothers, sisters, mothers, children, and fields, along with persecutions, and in the age to come, eternal life." So in other words, following Jesus might genuinely cost us in terms of relationships with people that are really close to us. That's really painful. It might cost us in terms of financial security and knowing what our future looks like and feeling independent. But God will not let us be in want. And he will provide in this life, this is the promise, the intimacy with him that keeps us going, but also the real joyous, intimate human relationships and a community that will help us all kind of provide for each other. I think that's what he means by fields here. And of course, he's also, I should say, very clear that if we don't take that deal, if we don't take that deal, we'll still lose our life eventually, because everybody does, right? But also we won't inherit eternal life, and even our life here on earth will be less full and less exciting and less of an adventure than it would have been. So it really is, he is claiming, win-win or lose-lose. That's a big promise for him to make, and I think it's fair for us to want to see some evidence of it. So here are some examples. I had a problem writing this bit because there are so many good examples of this in the Bible, where people have been obedient to God and trouble comes and God stays faithful to them. The one that I'm just only going to tell you about one of them, but there's a bit at the very beginning of the Acts of the Apostles, which if you're not very familiar with the Bible, is like the sequel to the Gospels. It's what happened after Jesus came back from the dead and went up to heaven. In chapters 3 and 4 of that, pretty much the first thing that happens is that two of the disciples, Peter and John, are walking to the temple. They see a guy who's got no use of his legs. They heal him in the name of Jesus. He starts walking and leaping and dancing and praising God. This immediately puts them in trouble with the religious authorities, who feel threatened because they thought they'd killed Jesus. And then they spend a night in the cells. They tell the authorities, look, we can't not tell people about this Jesus. He's the Messiah. You need to get with that or not, kind of thing. And then they go back to the disciples rejoicing, and they all pray together, and they get that comfort from the community that supports them, and even more comfort from knowing they've just seen the Spirit's power. So they're walking along in obedience, doing the stuff that Jesus did. They get challenged by people who are threatened by that, and they're immediately strengthened by God's Spirit. There's like a million different examples of that. I was really touched that, that Rich mentioned the bit in the letter to the Philippians where Paul, who was one of the big heroes of Acts, says, you know, I have counted everything as rubbish next to knowing Christ, because knowing Christ is that good. And if you read his story throughout Acts, you can see why he says that. He's not saying that to be religious. That's his actual experience. We don't have time to go through loads of these stories, but the Bible is full of people who walked in obedience, got in all sorts of trouble, or perhaps they just missed other opportunities, but God maintained his faithfulness to them. It's not just in the Bible, though. As we were talking about this, Fran reminded me of Corrie ten Boom. Does anybody know, do people vaguely know who that person is? Corrie ten Boom was an amazing lady. She was a Christian in Holland during the Nazi occupation in the 1940s. And she and her family were heavily involved in providing a hiding place for Jews and people who were involved in the resistance. They had special cupboards and secret rooms in their house, and families would live there for weeks at a time while they were smuggling them out of the country into safety. An incredibly dangerous thing to do, but they felt that God had called them to do that, and they saved dozens and dozens of lives. And in 1944, the sacrifice came to them. The family got caught. It got split up. Corrie and her sister Betsy went to a concentration camp where somehow they managed to organise worship services, and I think some people got saved because that was the kind of people they were. And over that year, her sister's health got worse and worse, and in December, she died. Betsy, not Corrie. And Betsy said before she died, there is no pit so deep that God is not deeper still. That was her experience of God's faithfulness, even there. Even weirder thing, after the war, Corrie ten Boom survived, and she started going around preaching about her experiences. And she met, I don't have time to tell you the whole story, but by chance slash by the grace of God, she met one of the Nazi officers who had tortured her, who asked her forgiveness, and with much pain, she granted it. And after that, after having done that, she did say, you will never know the touch of God as strongly as when you forgive your enemy. That's a sacrifice. There's a very famous audio recording of her telling that story. She tells it much better than I ever could. I don't have time to play it right now, but please, please do me a favour. Go on YouTube when you get home. It's about 4.5 minutes long. Just type in something like Corrie ten Boom Nazi officer forgiveness story or something like that. Have a listen to it. And I'm not very good at Googling, but it's incredible. It's an amazing story of somebody following Jesus and loving those whom it was not safe to love, and then forgiving someone whom she had every right to hate. And then again and again, God met her in those acts of sacrifice. One more example, and then I'm going to go on. I haven't got time to give that example. Ask me for that example later. It's really good. So, Jesus, that example, by the way, is another example from when we went to the Middle East. So if you all come to church next week at either the morning or the evening service, we might tell you that story. Hey? Jesus has been really clear that following him truly will lead you into sacrifice, whether you want it to or not. And he's been really, really clear that that could hurt. And he's been really, really clear that the benefits in this life and in the next make it worthwhile. So, what does it mean to me? the question for us is, I think, well, I think there's two questions we can be asking when we think about our relationship to this idea of sacrifice that Jesus asks of us. And the first thing I want to say is the only harsh thing that I'm going to say throughout the whole of this sermon. I don't feel too bad about that, because Jesus himself is being quite harsh when he's saying, you know, if you try to save your life, you'll lose it, stuff. So he's being fairly straight down the line, so I'm allowed to be as well. And my question is this: do I love Jesus more than my comfortable life? Because he really deserves for me to love him that way. And I need to ask him if I love him enough. Let me tell you something. When we were talking about this sermon last week, Fran asked me if I'd ever really sacrificed anything. And in that moment, I wasn't sure that I had, but I immediately knew a situation in which I would be happy to sacrifice anything. And that would be if any of her or my parents needed us to move closer to them. Both of our parents are in the East Midlands, are a few hours' drive away. And if, when they get sufficiently old and frail, that they need us on hand to care for them, I won't think twice. I'll probably grumble, actually. I'll be sad to leave Peckham. I'll be sad to leave All Saints. I'll be sad to leave all the culture and the fun that there is in London. But I'll do it. It won't even be a question. Because I love our mums more than I love our nice life in London. Do I consistently love God in that way? That more than my... There's nothing wrong with my nice life in London. But do I consistently love God in that way more than my nice life? There have been decisions I have made in my life where I have done the more sacrificial thing because it felt more like the thing that Jesus would do, or I felt specifically Jesus was calling me to do that thing. Whether that's been sacrificing money or convenience or risking social awkwardness or talking to someone, taking a risk on making a friend that I might not have otherwise made, it has always borne fruit. There have also been times, and if I'm honest, it's been more often recently, now that I've got more at stake in this world as I get older, when I've tried to pretend that I can't hear that voice telling me that this is what Jesus would probably do, because I like my life as it is, and I don't want to be ruffled. And if we really understood in the core of our being that Jesus is King, is Messiah, is the place where truth and life and hope reside in a way that you won't find anywhere else, would my ratio of obedience to non-obedience come out better? Of course it would. It's not even a question. But we need to know that Jesus deserves us to love him more than our comfortable life. And there's something else as well, which is, do we believe what he's promising? All this talk of sacrifice, and this is my last point, I promise. All this talk of sacrifice reminds me of my favourite one of Jesus' parables. It's really short, and it goes like this. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure that a man discovered hidden in a field. In his excitement, he hid it again and sold everything he owned to get enough money to buy the field. I love that image, right? This guy, he's an ordinary farm labourer. It's an ordinary, not especially exciting field. I think it's probably slightly remote because it's far enough away from the village and the main road and stuff that he can discover a massive treasure hoard, go, oh, I've got a massive treasure hoard here, and re-dig it back into the ground, and nobody knows. So it's pretty remote. And to everyone else, his behaviour must look really stupid. You're like, mate, winter's coming. Why have you just sold your only coat? And why is it like, what does his poor wife think? What, he sold, like, you know, the donkey or all the stuff that she uses for work or whatever. And she's like, remind me why I'm sitting on the floor in an empty house because you want to buy a rubbish field that's miles away from the village. But he knows that the reality is that all that sacrifice of not having any stuff, of everyone in the village thinking he's gone crazy, all that will buy him and his family something that will change their lives forever. And do we know that reality? Do I know that reality? Do we trust that? That if we throw ourselves on him, he will always catch us. that he will never leave us, nor all these promises that he will never leave us nor forsake us, that behold, I am with you till the end of the age. I am come that they might have life and have it in abundance. Anyone who's lost relationships or security because of me will get 100 times more love and security in this life and in the life to come. In this world, you will have many troubles, but take heart. I've overcome the world. And as with so many aspects of Christianity, I think I say, Lord, I believe. Help me overcome my unbelief. I wonder what you say. So that's where I stop. Prayer team are going to be... I don't know, what's the prayer team situation tonight? Is there a prayer team? Brilliant, there is a prayer team. I presume they'd probably be to my left, your right, at the front of church, behind the pillars. And they would love to pray with you about anything, or you might just want to pray with whoever you came with, or just on your own. Off the top of the head, I can think of 3 things that people might want to pray with someone about. First, I don't know whether God was speaking to anyone about this apart from me. Maybe it is just me, I don't know. But God demands and deserves that we love him more than our comfortable life. If you feel that God is poking you slightly in that regard of how much do we love him, I would say tell someone. Pray with someone. Google that Corrie ten Boom thing I was talking about. Read a gospel. Spend an hour alone with God. I don't know. Just do something that gives God the opportunity to make you see how big he is and how small you are. Do you know what I mean? And second, if you're like me and you want to believe that promise and you want to put your trust in his promise a little bit more and make the sacrifices, if you have a desire to just kind of give it a go, that God will give you that backbone or that strength, that trust in him, so that when the moment for sacrifice comes, you don't take the easy option, that's a great thing to pray about as well. Third, there might be people here, and this is my last thing, there might be people here who have already made some pretty big sacrifices for Jesus. You've died to yourself over and over again. You've chosen him rather than yourself or things that you thought would make you happy. And you're like, where are all these extra mothers and brothers and sisters? And when does the comfort kick in? I'm doing the sacrifice and it certainly feels like a little death, but where's all the comfort? Well, people would love to pray with you about that. Because, or just to help you create a space where you can kind of have that out with God or whatever you need to do. Because in the moment, I don't want, you know, talking about the promise, I don't want to belittle the fact that the sacrifice feels really bad in the moment. It can really hurt. But I don't think that we are meant to go through it alone. So let us be your 100 additional mothers and sisters and brothers and fields for the evening.